Yeah, so all of that is kind of the backdrop of what we basically already had for why Gandalf would have picked Bilbo. Back to this deleted scene, Gandalf's going to add on more to it, tell all, you know, because now he's Gandalf the White, his mission's complete, as we had heard, you know, so we got Gimli, Frodo, Merry, and Pippin supposedly listening to this. All right, Clifford, we're back again.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, Zoom's kind of slightly more annoying than Skype. It doesn't have a little box that shows up permanently.
Oh, yeah. There's probably some way to do that. We're just not Zoom experts.
No, we're not. Actually, I kind of... Well, no, I kind of should be, but I'm not, I guess. All right, whatever. All right, anyways, what are we doing today?
We're talking about Zoom. It's 2022.
No, we're not.
We are picking up where we left off with chapter 5 of book 6, The Steward and the King. And specifically, we're getting into some backstory on a few things that happened in this chapter.
Yeah, okay. So what we're drawing on here is, I wanted to put this at the end of the episode because there's basically, in the Unfinished Tales, there's at least one basically written, maybe post Lord of the Rings written deleted scene, you know, if you will, that happens in Minas Tirith. That's basically a tell all. It is a tell all, but we're not going to quite tell all today. There's still some Aragorn stuff probably to talk about later. And then I'm not going to tell all in this, but what I kind of wanted to do with this special was answer two questions. One should be nagging you since the first chapter of The Hobbit. The second potentially should be nagging you since the first chapter of The Hobbit. So, Clifford, do you want to take a guess what those are? Or do you know, or should I say them?
Well, in the first half of this episode, we speculated on this a little bit. We've talked about all the characters quite a bit, particularly Aragorn, Gandalf, Frodo, and their various roles as kind of priest, prophet, king. Right, and what they're fulfilling in the destruction of the ring and reviving the kingdom of Gondor. But Gandalf is this mysterious figure that's like in between the Valar, the gods, and Aragorn and Frodo, who are distinctly of Middle-earth. And yes. So my guess is who sent Gandalf? Or my guess of what the question ought to be, which is my question, is who sent Gandalf? Where did he come from? What's his motive? Who does he answer to? What's his purpose in life?
Like, we got a little snippet. What is he? What is he? And like, what are the wizards too? Yeah,
I believe that they're Maiar.
Oh, it's Clifford, you can't be spoiling this. Stop it.
Oh, okay.
We're getting to it.
I thought, you know, you'd be proud of me for remembering something for once.
Well, yeah. All right. No. So, all right. So, I've added enough of these things that I realize that you're remarkably good with Lord of the Rings trivia for okay. How terrible you are with Silmarillion trivia. All right. So the other, all right. And then let's just jump to the chase so that we can get started talking about it. The other big question, and this is what the actual deleted scene in Minas Tirith is about in the Unfinished Tales, is why did Gandalf choose Bilbo to start this whole adventure? Okay. So
yes.
Well, yeah, so to jump into it, the scene's supposed to be Gandalf, Frodo, Merry, Pippin, and Gimli are hanging out somewhere in Minas Tirith, and they're talking, and then it doesn't quite say this, but what I imagine is it's prompted by something like Gimli, he looks at Gandalf, and he says, okay, Gandalf, I know the whole story of what happened, but what made you or why did you choose Bilbo to start this whole adventure that led all the way from The Hobbit through to the destruction of the Ring? Okay, what was so special about Bilbo? Mm-hmm. All right. So we talked about this a little bit in the, or well, hopefully a decent amount in the Hobbit episodes that are literally 3 years old at this point. So go back to those maybe to hear more about this. But this is, again, this is supposed to be like the tell-all segment, okay? So cast your mind back, Clifford. Do you remember some of the things of why Bilbo was picked from the Hobbit episodes? I've actually re-listened to some of them, so or most of them. So I have some reasons ready to go, but what do you remember?
I remember we talked it quite a bit about Bilbo as he was the burglar, right?
Yeah,
he
was correct.
Like, I'm trying to remember what phrasing we were using at the time, but he was like the noble burglar or something.
Not the
like
warrior.
That.
There was no warriors available, so they got burglars. That was one of the phrases.
Right. Okay. And it was something to do with the fact that he was so unassuming, right? Like he was the unexpected choice, was actually a real asset to do something sneaky, right?
Yeah, and one very, very, very practical aspect of that is that Smaug, he had a really good sense of smell and he had never smelled a hobbit, so he wouldn't know what they are even. Mm. You know, so that was one part to it too. But then also, like, yeah, the unassumingness in general, hopefully that would help. One interesting thing that I remember that you were bringing up was you had this idea, at least back then, maybe you still do now, that's the other weird thing. Like, 3 years old ideas are 3 years old ideas. I mean, that's a long time. I don't know, like some ideas of mine, I think, have probably changed since then, but I don't know. It's very interesting to hear, so.
None of mine have changed.
If you say so. All right, so anyways, back then, maybe now, you had this interesting idea that there must have been something special about him if there's a whole story about him. Or maybe, you know, others tried these things and they failed and, you know, those people, you know, obviously you don't make stories about those people and aren't remembered by them. So it was another interesting thought.
Yeah, I still feel that way. Like, when we're looking at it in retrospect, you're like, what is this ridiculous chain of coincidences? Like, this is improbable for a story. But if you try to think of it from the perspective of history, it's not like we're looking at every story. It's that we happen to be reading a story that's, you know, like the most unique stories are the ones that happen to be about this crazy set of coincidences or something, or set of events that happens to someone. Yeah.
Another practical reason that we must have hit on, but we might not have hit on it until the end of the book because it was slightly a big reveal, is that in the first chapter, Bilbo was becoming a mini Smaug himself, like a curmudgeon lord of Bag End, basically. Mm. You know, and so he needed the adventure to take another major step in maturity, basically, you know, or come of age or grow, you know. So
yeah.
which successfully worked, besides that he nursed the ring for 60 years after that. But he's still, I don't know, he for somebody that had the ring for that long, he did pretty well. So
I've got to ask, maybe we're going to get to this, how could Gandalf, in picking Bilbo to go start the Hobbit journey, go find Smaug, did Gandalf know anything about the ring at that time, besides knowing that it might in theory exist somewhere?
They knew of the ring. Did they think it was washed down into the sea yet? Saruman knew about the ring, and he already had spies searching the Gladden Fields. I don't know if Gandalf knew about that at the time of Bilbo's thing. We'll get into that a little bit here, too.
Okay.
And Gandalf obviously knew about the ring existed at one point, and Gandalf might have had premonitions that it was going to come back up.
Okay.
Because he also knew about the Rings of Power, and he probably understood that the Rings of Power are controlled by or connected to the One Ring. So if that were destroyed, then those wouldn't work. But he knows those work, you know. Because one of the things that we saw with those is that Lothlorien and Rivendell, it's the rings of the people that wear those that preserve those kingdoms so magically well, basically. Because the elves' time should have already come, but when the ring's destroyed, then the elves' time does come because the ring's destroyed, and then the three rings lose their power, right?
Right.
So Gandalf knew all that, but yeah, he always knew that Bilbo had a magic ring when he got it, but he didn't know it was the ring until he searched out with Aragorn to get Gollum, at the beginning, and then he showed up with Frodo and they threw it in the fire, and that was the final proof. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Just sorry, jump back a little bit. The only other things too, why Gandalf might have chosen Bilbo that we kind of talked about, and this one goes for the other hobbits as well. It's like, okay, you make the right choice over the best choice, and our example for that was the Miracle movie, you know, the Disney movie, like the Olympics, where you know, the guy picked his whole team before the tryouts even started because he basically interviewed all the coaches and knew the right guys to pick who would mesh well mm-hmm. together and be good leaders and good teammates and everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other one too is, I just listened to it again because we're recording this at the end of March. I always listen to this during March. It's one of my favorite talks I've ever heard. I'll clip it in, but it's from the Jim Valvano coach, who's the 1983 NC State. They miraculously won the NCAA tournament for basketball, March Madness. Uh-huh. You know, because like they were one of the ones where if they didn't win their conference tournament, they wouldn't have made the tournament that year. So they had basically, that's, I don't know, four elimination games or something, and then you got mm-hmm. five or six more elimination games in the tournament. So they had to win all of them, and they were all ridiculously close, and it came down to a ridiculously close basket at the end. And then there's an ESPN 30 for 30 about it, and they have clips through there from one of his big long like 50 minute talks or something, and so I found the uh-huh. 50 minute talk on YouTube, and then I don't know, there's just some parts of it that are just never gets old, like rocks my world. It's awesome. And one of the things that he says in there is God must love ordinary people because he made so many of them, and ordinary people do very extraordinary things. And like, I don't know, it was just it was one of the best parts of it. I'll probably have clipped it in by now.
Okay.
All right, I think everybody has to have a personal philosophy of how you live your life. Here's mine, very simply put. You plus motivation equals success. I have that only thing in my locker room. There's nothing else in my locker room but that sign. You plus motivation equals success. I have it on cards, bookmarkers. I have it on everything. It drives me. It's a passion. I was 16 years old. I heard the Reverend Bob Richards speak. Remember him, the Wheaties guy, the decathlon pole vault champion Olympics? And this is what he said. Right? Gentleman said it before, but this is what I was 16. Bob Richards looked over a group of these young kids at a basketball camp and said, the Lord must have loved ordinary people because he made so many of us. And here I am 16 thinking I'm special, and here's a man I respect said, the Lord must have loved ordinary people. He made so many of us ordinary. And I was a little, you know, you get a little down at 16 when someone's telling you that. And then he said the line that changed my life at 16 that I felt then. I'm 41 years old. I've been working 21 years in my business, and I feel it the same way today. He said, every single day, in every walk of life, ordinary people do extraordinary things. Ordinary people accomplish extraordinary things. And I raised my hand. I'm applying for the job right now. I'm an ordinary guy. I want to do extraordinary things in my life. And I believe it. I think that's strong. I think that's what it's all about.
Yeah, so all of that is kind of the backdrop of what we basically already had for why Gandalf would have picked Bilbo. Back to this deleted scene, Gandalf's going to add on more to it, tell all, you know, because now he's mm-hmm. Gandalf the White, his mission's complete as we had heard, you know, so we got Gimli, Frodo, Merry, and Pippin supposedly listening to this. So where Gandalf starts is he does go to the Hobbit and he says he knew Sauron was in Mirkwood at the time of the Hobbit, okay? Mm-hmm. So, and he knew it was Sauron in Dol Guldur, right? Because that's what he leaves the Hobbit mission to go fight, I guess. And by this mm-hmm. point, Tolkien writes that Saruman was already annoying him and, you know, kind of messing with his plans. Mm-hmm. So again, how much Gandalf knew about the ring at that point, the ring, or if Bilbo had the ring, is, I don't know, hazy. Because mm-hmm. it was hazy for Gandalf too, I guess. You know, that's the real thing about it. But anyways, Gandalf figured Sauron, in Mirkwood, he was planning to attack Rivendell and Lothlorien as soon as he was strong enough. And at that point, there was no strong kingdom in the north of Middle-earth, or in that part of Middle-earth that, you know, could have stop Sauron. Even in the dragon in the Lonely Mountain, Smaug, could have really helped him with that too. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, while he's worrying about all these troubles, especially the dragon, Gandalf decides to get some rest and recovery and go on a retreat basically, to the Shire to clear his head, because he always has enjoyed hanging out with the hobbits. But in Bree, as chance would have it, he meets Thorin Oakenshield for the first time, probably at the Prancy Pony. And Thorin's ideas are all, like, extremely warlike and warrior-like, but he's planning on taking the Lonely Mountain back. And so Gandalf says, okay, yeah, let me get involved with this because I hate this dragon. I want to get rid of this so that Sauron doesn't have it, you know, at his disposal, and, you know, for any sort of alliance. But he didn't think any of the warrior and warlike stuff was practical at all, though he didn't say it, okay?
Okay.
So this then he goes...
Okay, sorry, keep going.
So this is like about a couple months before the Hobbit expedition would depart from...
Does this mean, like, Battle of the Five Armies, Gandalf is like...
Well, before...
Wish that didn't happen or something.
It's before Bilbo and the dwarves set out for the Lonely Mountain.
Right. Right, but eventually, it's not much of a question. Let's keep going.
Okay. All right, so he goes to get news from the Shire, and then I'm going to read part of this here, because it was all just pretty good to just quote straight, and it's actually kind of funny, too. And this is Gandalf speaking about, basically introducing Bilbo here. Somehow I had been attracted by Bilbo long before as a child and as a young hobbit. He had not quite come of age when I had last seen him. He had stayed in my mind ever since, with his eagerness and his bright eyes and his love of tales and his questions about the whole world outside the Shire. As soon as I entered the Shire, I heard news of him. He was getting talked about, it seemed. Both his parents had died early for Shire folk, at about 80. And he had never married. He was already growing a bit queer, they said, and went off for days by himself. He could even be seen talking to strangers, even dwarves. All right, so that actually sounds kind of surprising based on reading the whole Hobbit. Would you agree or disagree?
Yeah, wait, so that was the description of Bilbo before?
Before, yes, yeah.
That's very peculiar.
Yeah, so it seems to be adding in a bit here. Okay, all right, so let me keep going with this. Even dwarves. Suddenly, in my mind, these three things came together. The great dragon with his lust and his keen hearing and scent, the sturdy, heavy-booted dwarves with their old burning grudge, and the quick, soft-footed hobbit, sick at heart, I guessed, for a whole sight of the wide world. I laughed at myself, but went off at once to have a look at Bilbo, to see what 20 years had done to him, and whether he was as promising as gossip seemed to make out. But he was not at home. They shook their heads in Hobbiton when I asked after him. Off again, said one hobbit. It was Holman, the gardener, I believe. And that's Holman, who's Sam Gamgee's grandpa, I guess.
Oh, interesting.
is what this notes. Off again. He'll go right off one of these days if he isn't careful. Why, I asked him where he was going and when he would be back. And I don't know, he says. And then he looks at me queerly. It depends if I meet any, Holman, he says. It's the elves' New Year tomorrow. A pity, and to him so kind a body. You wouldn't find a better from the downs to the river. All right. So again, this also seemed kind of out of character for me, based on Bilbo from the beginning of the book, right?
Right. This is making him sound way more adventurous than the Hobbit, than the Bilbo we met at the very first pages
of the Hobbit. Right. But Tolkien's good. He's going to get this together. So this is watch him string this back. Okay. Better and better, I thought, and this is, again, still Gandalf talking. I think I shall risk it. Time was getting short. I had to be with the White Council in August at the latest, or Saruman would have his way and nothing would be done. And quite apart from greater matters, that might prove fatal to the quest. The power in Dol Guldur would not leave any attempt on Erebor unhindered, unless he had something else to deal with. So I rode back to Thorin in haste to tackle the difficult task of persuading him to put aside his lofty designs and go secretly and take Bilbo with him, without seeing Bilbo first. It was a mistake and nearly proved disastrous, for Bilbo had changed, of course. At least he was getting rather greedy and fat, and his old desires had dwindled down to a sort of private dream. Nothing could have been more dismaying than to find it actually in danger of coming true. He was altogether bewildered and made a complete fool of himself. Thorin would have left in a rage, but for another strange chance, while I mentioned it in a moment. But you know how things went, at any rate, as Bilbo saw them. The story would have sounded much rather different if I had written it. For one thing, he did not realize at all how fatuous the dwarves thought him, nor how angry they were with me. Thorin was much more indignant and contemptuous than he perceived. He was indeed contemptuous from the beginning and thought that I had planned the whole affair simply to make a mock of him. It was only the map and key that saved the situation. So, all right, so what do you make of all that?
The last part I was a little bit confused, but so that's the turn of events that put Bilbo into the character that we know him to be from the start of The Hobbit.
Yeah.
So it sounds like he had an adventurous youth and then slowly got less adventurous until he was the old curmudgeon in his hole.
And more so than even having an adventurous youth, he dreamed of having an adventurous life.
Okay.
That key line is nothing could have been more dismaying than to find that dream actually in danger of coming true. I think that's such a good line.
But, that was Bilbo's dismay?
Yes. Yes. So Bilbo, like, he became the homebody who is so comfortable there that it's like, oh, I had dreamed about an adventure, and now it's like, oh, I would never want that to actually happen.
Right.
I'm too comfortable here. And it's like, Yeah, so I don't know. I think that meshes up with everything that we've learned or saw in The Hobbit, I would say. I thought the other interesting part of this is Gandalf telling all. He's saying, yeah, I was making some mistakes throughout that one. Because, we read Lord of the Rings. It's like him and Aragorn's like, they never do anything wrong. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, this sounds like he's playing a game of chess and he's like, missed that one.
Lost a couple pawns by accident. Yeah. and it's funny that, I found it funny that Thorin and the dwarves really hated him at first. That's basically what they're saying. It's like, if I or the dwarves had written the book, it would not have been as wholesome for the first couple chapters talking about Bilbo. and so that actually continues too in this next section that I want to read here. Thorin was contemptuous and suspicious. He is soft, he snorted, soft as the mud of his shire, and silly. His mother died too soon. You are playing some crooked game of your own, Master Gandalf. I am sure that you have other purposes than helping me.
You are quite right, I said. If I had no other purposes, I should not be helping you at all. Great as your affairs may seem to you, they are only a small strand in the great web. I am concerned with many strands, but that should make my advice more weighty, not less. I spoke at last with great heat. Listen to me, Thorin Oakenshield, I said. If this hobbit goes with you, you will succeed. If not, you will fail. A foresight is on me, and I am warning you.
I know your fame, Thorin answered. I hope it is merited. But this foolish business of your hobbit makes me wonder whether it is foresight that is on you, and you are not crazed rather than foreseeing. So many cares may have disordered your wits.
They have certainly been enough to do so, I said. And among them I find most exasperating a proud dwarf who seeks advice from me, without claim on me that I know of, and then rewards me with insolence. Go on your own ways, Thorin Oakenshield, if you will, but if you flout my advice you will walk to disaster, and you will get neither counsel nor aid from me again until the shadow falls on you. And curb your pride and your greed, or you will fall at the end of whatever path you take, though your hands be full of gold.
He blenched a little at that, but his eyes smoldered. Do not threaten me, he said. I will use my own judgment in this matter, as in all that concerns me.
Do so then, I said. I can say no more unless it is this. I do not give my love or trust lightly, Thorin, but I am fond of this hobbit and I wish him well. Treat him well and you shall have my friendship to the end of your days. I said that without hope of persuading him, but I could have said nothing better. Dwarves understand devotion to friends and gratitude to those who help them.
Very well, Thorin said at last after a silence. He shall set out with my company, if he dares, which I doubt. But if you insist on burdening him with me, you must come too and look after your darling.
Good, I answered. I will come and stay with you as long as I can, at least until you have discovered his worth. It proved well in the end, but at this time I was troubled, for I had the urgent matter of the White Council on my hands. So it was that the quest of Erebor set out. I do not suppose that when it started, Thorin had any real hope of destroying Smaug. There was no hope. Yet it happened. But alas, Thorin did not live to enjoy his triumph or his treasure. Pride and greed overcame him in spite of my warning. But surely, I said, he might have fallen in battle anyway. There would have been an attack of orcs, however generous Thorin had been with his treasure. That is true.
Hold on. That line's Frodo. That's the really confusing thing about this.
Oh, okay.
But surely, Frodo said, he might have fallen in battle anyways. There would have been an attack of orcs, however generous Thorin had been with his treasure.
That is true, said Gandalf. Poor Thorin. He was a great dwarf of a great house, whatever his faults. And though he fell at the end of the journey, it was largely due to him that the kingdom under the mountain was restored, as I desired. But Dane for Ironfoot was a worthy successor. And now we hear that he fell fighting before Erebor again, even while we fought here. I should call it a heavy loss. It was not a wonder, rather, that in his great age he could still wield his axe as mightily as they say he did, standing over the body of King Brand before the gate of Erebor until darkness fell. It might all have gone very differently indeed. The main attack was diverted southwards, it is true. Yet even so, with his far-stretched right hand, Sauron could have done terrible harm in the north. While he defeated Gondor, if King Brand and King Dane had not stood in his path, when you think of the great battle of Pelennor, do not forget the battle of Dale. Think of what might have been, dragonfire and savage shores in Eriador. There might have been no queen in Gondor. We might now only hope to return from the victory here to ruin and ash. But that has been averted, because I met Thorin Oakenshield one evening on the edge of spring, not far from Bree. A chance meeting, as we say in Middle-earth.
Okay, so what do we think of that?
Whoa, okay, so that sounds like some major plot backstory that we've not heard before.
Right. Tell almost that, all episode.
This is like the Eastern Front of this war with I guess it's the Northern Front of the war with Sauron.
Well, yeah, I'm starting kind of back
to front also on these comments. Northeastern Front that we only heard about Gondor, but Sauron was launching a full on offensive in the north.
There were subtle comments, I think back around like Helm's Deep, that Gimli and Legolas knew that war was on their home fronts as well, and Lothlorien might have been gearing up for it before the Fellowship left.
Right.
But yeah, very subtle. So.
Right.
But yeah, so this is why this episode would have kind of fit better with the fifth chapter itself, you know, because it's like you go over this stuff. But yeah,
right.
What happened was, while Gondor-Pelennor Field battle was going on, Sauron sent a couple armies north, one attacking Lothlorien, and the Ents, I think, were actually protecting Rohan's north border, too. I think that's, like, a crucial thing in there. One army in Mirkwood was fighting Legolas's people, while maybe another or a branch of that same army went for Dale and the Lonely Mountain, and probably, you know, you assume Lake Town as well, right? And so it said King Brand, which is Bard's grandson, the guy that shot Smaug down, and Dane, who was Thorin's cousin and successor in The Hobbit, both died in that battle. Dane, it's more so like kind of finally. Like, I mean, he was, I don't know, he must have been like 300 or something. So. And then I think these elves were fighting in Mirkwood too, and after the shadows pass, so after the ring's destroyed, Galadriel and Celeborn actually go immediately to Dol Guldur and destroy it to its roots too. They actually do that before they come for the wedding. So kind of interesting. But as far as like to the talking about Bilbo, I don't know. I thought it was funny how Thorin was saying he's soft, and Gandalf, he's not just helping Thorin, definitely not just for his own sake, right? Like, I'm concerned with many strands, and so like the strands, the webs, or the many threads make a saga, you know, like providential plans basically is what Gandalf's in charge of there, is what it
right it sounds like some classic, like, or the way Gandalf is describing it now sounds like one of those kind of like, not nothing happens by chance, but almost like butterfly effect type of ripples throughout the world. Like Gandalf is even if he didn't know totally what was going on when he started certain things in motion, he knew that it was important that he started them in motion to set up this whole clockwork thing that eventually paid off.
Right. And in the last line of it, a chance meeting, as we say in Middle Earth, like we can go back to The Hobbit and you can listen to all the episodes, and it's like chance equals luck, which isn't just gambling luck. You know, this is, that's the code word for providence. Already heard. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's what Gandalf's basically talking about. I don't know. I thought the key line was that Bilbo was scared of the dream coming true as far as Bilbo goes, but this kind of just does roll straight into Gandalf. But unless you have anything else on Bilbo or any of the other backstory. We could move on or say it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. All right, so this prompts the other topic.
Wait, sorry. Can I? Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Back let's up. Do it.
Okay. Bilbo, that explains why Gandalf picked Bilbo for the Hobbit. But Gandalf didn't know about the ring when the Hobbit started. Or he knew it existed, but he didn't think it would be associated with Bilbo necessarily.
Oh, no, he did not think it would be associated with Bilbo.
Okay, yeah. So in a way that's like nothing happens by chance type of thing, and he just rolled with it.
Mm.
It happened to work out that way, but it wasn't necessarily part of his original plan that he was going to pick a hobbit to go destroy the ring.
Yeah, and we didn't read all of that little story, but like it just really highlights that Gandalf was, I mean, he's openly like, yeah, that was a mistake on my part. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it's, you know, like rolling with it is probably pretty damn close to exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, it's like, all right, I'm just trying, you know, he's got the right principles, you know, and he'll do the right thing, but it's not always the practical right thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's a moral right thing, you know, everything he does, but it's not always the perfect thing to do in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of feels like he's playing so many moves in advance, like he's setting up dominoes to go off way in the future, that he doesn't totally, he's like super smart, he could follow all these moves ahead of time, like chess players mapping out all the permutations of what the next moves are, but he can only go so far, so he's like,
or
clearly has some sense of what he's starting, but doesn't know what the end result is yet, but is doing it anyways.
Or he's like me in chess, where I don't do the permutations and figure it out, but I just know what good moves are, and I just do them, because it's like, oh, something good usually comes from doing this, you know? So so maybe that's how Gandalf's kind of working, where it's like...
Or somewhere in between.
It's more likely somewhere in between, but I'm just saying there's no in between. I'm just like, I don't know. You always move your bishop to the fourth row. Like that works. Never the fifth row. The fourth row works, not the fifth. Yeah. All right. So anyways, we're already talking about Gandalf. So that's why I wanted to lump in the other topic here too. I guess it was ambitious to ever think that this could have all been with chapter 5, but whatever. Let's finally get into it. Who are Gandalf and the Wizards? Why/who sent them on mission to Middle-earth? And the White Rider chapter, Gandalf, he famously has a quote as soon as he comes back. He says, "I have been sent back until my task is done." In this past chapter, he was finally talking to Aragorn at the top of the mountain, and he says that, yeah, my task is done. You know, my age was fighting Sauron, right? You know, so anyways... Again, from Unfinished Tales, there's a whole chapter, and this chapter was written in 1954, which is right around the publication of Lord of the Rings. Hopefully I have the date right this time, because I got that Leif by Niggle date wrong of when he wrote it versus published. Kills me. But anyways, this explanation that we're going to draw on from about all the wizards should jive pretty well with Lord of the Rings. Like, he hasn't fine-tuned or tinkered with anything, but... I don't know. Everything after Lord of the Rings jives together. But any comments, thoughts before we jump in? Predictions?
No.
Okay. All right. So wizard, it's a translation from the Quenya word istari. Istari is more literally just means wise. Okay.
So like the wizard wise ones.
Right. So, or wise men, you know, at Christmas. So.
Actually, is that also what the root is in English? Like, is wizard related to wise?
I bet you're right.
Okay, all right.
I bet Tolkien would know the connection. I don't know. Too bad we can't get him on the podcast. the wizards of this first order. All right, sorry. So these wizards, they appear in Middle Earth as old men around the year 1000 of the Third Age. Okay, so Lord of the Rings takes place in the Third Age, but in the year 3018 is when all the big events happen. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we're like 2000 years before that, right? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But for a very long time, men barely saw them at all, and the wizards just basically sponged up everything they could learn about Middle-earth before revealing their power. Okay?
Okay.
So let's just recap too. What wizards have we met in Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit?
Gandalf, obviously.
Yeah.
Saruman.
Yeah.
Radagast, briefly.
Yeah. And that's it. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so if we, and just to make sure that we're clear and don't get confused, the Second Age ends with the destruction of Numenor, the Last Alliance, and then finally, officially, when Isildur cuts the ring off Sauron's finger and they defeat Mordor for good. Or they thought for good. But as the shadow of Sauron began to grow and take shape again, they, the wizards, became more active and sought ever to contest the growth of the shadow and to move elves and men to become aware of their peril. Okay, so that at that point, you know, as the Third Age draws on, they become popular among everybody because they actually start doing more stuff. They're not just learning about their environment anymore. Mm-hmm. And men become aware that, hey, these guys don't die, right?
Yeah.
Men therefore grew to fear them, even when they loved them. And men assumed they were elves because, you know, they're immortal or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to take that, yet they were not so, quote? It's just everything that I wrote there.
Yet they were not so, for they came from over the sea, out of the uttermost west. Emissaries they were from the Lord of the West, the Valar, who still took counsel for the governance of Middle-earth. And when the shadow of Sauron began to first stir again, they took this means of resisting him. For with the consent of Eru Iluvatar, they sent members of their own high order, but clad in the bodies of men, real and not feigned, but subject to the fears and pains and weariness of earth, able to hunger and thirst and be slain, though because of their noble spirits they did not die, and aged only by the cares and labors of many long years. And this the Valar did, desiring to amend the errors of old, especially that they had attempted to guard and seclude the Eldar by their own might and glory fully revealed, whereas now their emissaries were forbidden to reveal themselves in forms of majesty, or to seek to rule the wills of men or elves by open display of power, but coming in shapes weak and humble were bidden to advise and persuade men and elves to good, and to seek to unite in love and understanding all those whom Sauron, should he come again, would endeavor to dominate and corrupt.
All right, that's pretty big.
Okay.
Lots of stuff explicitly said, right?
Okay, so wizards sent from the Valar in the West.
Yeah.
Is the West synonymous with the Undying Lands where the elves go?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
And they also even have the consent and blessing of Eru Iluvatar, who's outside the world, but, you know, they're the emissaries of him, you know, all the Valar are.
And then we've got sounds like the people being sent, the wizards, are members of their own high order. Like,
yes.
They're grouped in with the Valar.
So, all right. So let's just get this out of the way now. Yeah. I wanted to do this now. Okay. So remember, it goes Iluvatar. Mm-hmm. He creates the Ainur who make the music of the Ainur, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so of the Ainur, all the Valar and Melkor are Ainur. And then they create the world. They go into the world. Then they have to actually create the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is, the top 15 of the Ainur that go into the world become the Valar. The rest are then called Maiar, and they're just lesser Ainur, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they would be talking about when they say get somebody out of their order. Okay.
Okay. So it's like a big Venn diagram. The Ainur include everyone.
Yes.
Basically everyone under Iluvatar that's somewhat godlike.
Well,
and
so
within that,
so Iluvatar is the god, and then they would be the angels under that. When they get into this world, it slightly shifts because now the Valar seem like Greek god-like. Or Norse gods, you know?
Right.
But they are still angels too, and then the Maiar seem like demigods, but they are still angels too, you know?
Okay.
But yeah, it's Venn diagrams for sure.
complex Venn diagram. Okay, so they're sending, the Valar are sending members of their own order in the bodies of men. This sounds interesting. Like they're apologizing. They're trying to make good on their errors of old, which sounds like they've maybe tried to protect the Eldar, the elves, openly previously, treating them like children or something.
Well, they did that by inviting them to stay in Valinor with them. and just thinking like, oh, isn't it just better here than being in Middle Earth? And it wasn't for the Noldor because they left and started the whole Silmarillion conflict, right?
Okay.
So like, so you know, the free wills of the elves and men can still clash with the free wills of the Valar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even in Valinor, basically. Go on.
Then this other part is pretty interesting. They have to be emissaries. They're hidden. They can't be majestic. Basically, like it sounds like, even though they're more powerful than anything in the world, they can't go be the kings of men. They have to persuade them with love, basically. And they have to take weak and humble forms.
Yeah. Okay. So
pretty interesting.
Right. So practically, that explains why Gandalf is kind of this unassuming guy, especially when he's Gandalf the Grey. It's like,
right,
come on, you're a wizard.
He's an old, you know, old
I've
man
seen Harry Potter. Yeah, I've seen Harry Potter. They do super awesome spells. You know, like, why can't you do this? Mm-hmm. It's like, he can, he's just not allowed to. It's kind of the secret answer.
It's pretty interesting, though. It's like the intent is that he can't coerce anyone to do anything. He has to motivate them or persuade them to do it of their own will.
Yeah. The other thing,
that's a big difference. Like, if he became a king, he could tell people what to do.
Right.
Here, he has to get people to do things by their own decision, by working his powers, not necessarily by deceiving them, but by convincing them of a particular way.
And it's for their own good, too. But it's like, I can help. I think what we've always said is the best word that we've used is Gandalf's like a facilitator throughout Lord of the Rings. Yeah, this is this is the mission statement of why he's like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would say, too, is if you remember from the Silmarillion, at one point early on, they fight Melkor and they capture him. That's when the elves are woken up originally so that they could protect the elves and invite them to Valinor and they could travel safely over.
Mm-hmm.
Then Melkor escapes. They start the whole Silmarillion and it all ends with Arendil coming over to Valinor to plead for help. And then the Valar send an army to Middle Earth that time, but the Valar themselves don't go that time. It's actually the top Maiar and a bunch of other Maiar led by Ionwy, who's kind of like, in quotes, the son of Manwë and Varda, which isn't true because they're all angels here, right? They were all Maiar in the music of the Ainur, right? So like.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't be their son. You guys don't actually have kids. But,
right.
You know, just think of it like have fun with, like, the Greek, you know, god family trees that point. Just roll with that, you know, with that idea. But so anyways, they send them, right? But, like, the super strongest ones don't go. And then now, well, then Numenor falls and they defeat Sauron the first time. And the elves and Numenoreans kind of just got it and they just handle them the first time, so they don't even have to send anybody from Valinor. But now this time, no great armies, no Valar, you know, you're gonna get a couple Maiar in disguise, or a handful of Maiar in disguise, basically.
Right.
So it's kind of weird how, like, each generation, massive age-long generation, you're getting less and less, which mm-hmm. is kind of I don't know, lame, but it's also, well, I don't know. I say lame because, like, you see this actually in Greek mythology and Norse mythology, probably most mythologies, is that it's really way, way, way larger than life. But then as you get more close to real time, it becomes, I don't know, more realistic or relatable, I guess, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, have you noticed that? Ever noticed that? Like, if you read the Edda, that is what happens too in the Poetic Edda. Like, I just listened to that a couple of months
ago. As it goes on in time, it becomes more realistic.
Well, it starts all with the god stories, and then by the end of it, you're just getting all the men stories about, like, Sigurd, who's the guy that slayed Fafnir the dragon, which is what he got Turin and Glaurung from. Inspired that.
I feel like that makes sense, though, for, like, a history. Like, it's, like,
right.
this gradient from, like, cosmology, epistemology, all the way through to the one reading the story.
Yeah. And, like, the Greek gods, they start with Cronus and Uranus, who are, like, the most elemental gods. And then you get more specific gods like Zeus, and who's, like, god of, I don't know, just air. Whereas Cronus was, like, god of, he wasn't time, but maybe it was time. Whatever. Anyways, you get stuff like that.
He was kind of like the Iluvatar for the Greek gods, right? Like, above whole like layer.
Quiver. Hold on.
Don't mix it up. Okay.
Now we got to go back. Now I got to reference G.K. Chesterton, Everlasting Man. He'll say that none of those Greek gods actually function as the Iluvatar god. Is what he would.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So that's. I don't know, big stuff. All right. Anyways, let's keep going with this. Let's not get too sidetracked here. Okay. Oh, but also, like, keeping the disguise. Do we think Gandalf ever broke that at any points?
Broke the disguise. Well, maybe when he becomes Gandalf the White.
Yeah, potentially. What about any times when he's the Gray?
He definitely reveals his wizardness in a lot of ways. I feel like that's like, it's like a low key.
Yeah, but fireworks don't
people
count.
People know he's not just an old man.
Goofy fireworks don't count. And yeah.
But even.
And wisdom's fine. He's just smart. Right? Yeah.
But
he's
I feel
wise.
Like even.
Like,
even
there's one specific time I'm trying to say.
Okay. When he's fighting at some point.
What does he fight?
Before the Balrog, before he becomes Gandalf the Light.
No, not before the Balrog.
Before the Balrog?
The Balrog.
The Balrog, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that might have been like the one time where, I don't know, he gets a little bit more over the top than we'd ever seen him. And so right. The reason for that is because, well, the Balrog, if you read the Silmarillion, they're made out of a Maiar spirit as well. So they're one of this higher
it's
order.
Be like
so
apples to apples,
right? So that one might have been a justified fair fight. Also with the disguise thing too, we're definitely. What else do you think of that? Like disguises old men. What else does that sound like in mythology?
I feel there's so many examples.
Right, there's
of
a
old
lot
men in mythology of right. being like it's like a hidden thing. Like
yeah,
I feel like it's a classic thing in a lot of.
And who are like, they usually? Who are they really, but when they disguise themselves as an old man?
Like gods or something.
Right, correct. So, yeah.
Yeah,
so
like I'm thinking like Norse mythology, like Odin would walk around as an old beggar, right?
And he recruits people for Valhalla. He's looking for warriors.
But then it also seems kind of biblical. Like it's like this, like the idea of like a beggar on the street. It's like a test of people, kind of like a parable. I feel like that's one aspect of it where it's not like Gandalf showing up and you know he's this great powerful guy and so you're going to join forces with him. Instead, it's like, do you take the chance to actually listen to what he's saying or do you reject it out of hand because of his appearance?
Yeah, what you're kind of saying is almost even too like the Greeks had the tradition like, you know, if a stranger comes up to your house and asks to be fed for the night, you do it.
Right.
Probably practically because the stranger needs it. Like, cause there's a Walmart. Right? You know? Uh-huh. But then, from a cultural standpoint, it might be a god in disguise, right? And you're not going to piss off any of those people. Plus, you know, and that fosters good hospitality, which is good for a culture, period. As far as a Christian biblical imagery, I thought it doesn't quite approach Christ incarnate, you know, like Jesus entering the world. But what it does approach is more like Gabriel messenger angel appearing kind of stuff.
Okay.
In my opinion, and then I think Tolkien would kind of line up with that. And as we've already kind of said, Gandalf's like an angel in this in these books too.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's probably enough talking about that. I would assume.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So five wizards are going to come from across the sea. One clad in white. Great skill he had in works of hand, and he was regarded by well nigh all, even by the Eldar, as the head of the order. Who's this?
Saruman.
Yep. Okay. Two clad in sea blue, one in earthen brown. And last came one who seemed the least. Less tall than the others, and in looks more aged, gray-haired and gray-clad and leaning on a staff. But Círdan, from the first meeting at the Grey Havens, divined in him the greatest spirit and the wisest, and he welcomed him with reverence, and he gave to his keeping a gift I'm not ready to spoil yet. This is the almost tell-all episode. Almost for this exact reason. But we remember Círdan's the elf that just always lived as far to the west of, but stayed in Middle Earth as he could. He loves the sea. He's one of the Teleri elves and was related to Thingol, and then I don't know who else. I guess he'd be related to Celeborn now, who people left. So, anyways, yeah, he's just always there, and he runs the Great Havens of the elves sailing across to the west. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, that kind of answers basically like why the wizards were sent, but who are they themselves? Okay, so like they come from Valar across the sea, but who are they in Valinor? Right. We can keep diving into this. This goes deeper, right? Peeling back the layers of the onion. Okay. Right? All right. Okay. So Tolkien doesn't have any narrative or essays on this besides some jotted outlines that Christopher Tolkien combed over to basically piece this together. And here's what Chris Tolkien figured out just from like the rapid notes, basically. And again, these ideas were probably evolving in Tolkien's head, and he forget exactly which idea he was going for. So it was like a mess to kind of go through all these notes, but... Anyways, this is the most streamlined thing that Christopher Tolkien came up with, and then I recorded at, I don't know, probably faithfully to what he wrote down, but I assume, I don't know, read the chapter of Unfinished Tales for yourself to hear everything, but I'm streamlining this a little bit. All right, So it sets out, hypothetical outlined conversation, he would have written this at some point maybe if he'd got around to it. Manwë, remember Manwë, he's the head of the Valar. Oh, I just told you. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's the heir, send the eagles, right, okay. And he's but he's not, Ilúvatar is still higher than him, but he's like the Zeus of this world, okay.
Right.
All right, so he calls a council of the Valar to figure out what's to be done about combating Sauron in Middle-earth, because he's rising again, you know, after his defeat in the Second Age, at the end of the Second Age. And Manwë says, with Ilúvatar's influence, who would go? For they must be mighty, peers of Sauron, but must forego might and clothe themselves in flesh so as to treat on equality and win the trust of elves and men. But this would imperil them, dimming their knowledge and wisdom and confusing their fears, cares, and wearinesses coming from the flesh. Mm. Thoughts on that?
They have to be made more human-like to be convincing, but also it's clearly a flaw. They're not going to do outright one-on-one battle with Sauron.
Right, they're being sent as it's like not going to be might versus
communicator
might.
Communicator almost.
Yeah.
They're being sent as a facilitator.
Right. Oh, and also, peers of Sauron. I think we already knew this at this point, but what's Sauron? Like, what level?
Maiar.
Yeah, right? So he's a Maiar, but he gets so powerful, especially after he created the One Ring, that he basically... Especially for his section of Middle Earth, he becomes, for all intents and purposes, a Valar almost.
Yeah. But like Manwë level, Manwë level.
Not really. If it came down to it, I think. But like he gets so powerful in his concentrated area of like Mordor and all the other stuff that he rules that he's like worse than Melkor was. Just abstractly, kind of just ruining everything, you know. So
at this point, why doesn't Manwë just go over and say, mess up Sauron, say you can't do this anymore? Is it important that the men and elves fight the battle themselves?
Yeah, so that kind of, I think that kind of gets back towards, it goes back to like how in all mythology it's like almost, you know, lesser and lesser each generation, it becomes more real. And that's also the theme of Lord of the Rings, where the elves are fading away, dwarves are fading away, hobbits aren't going to last forever. They're all trying to defeat Sauron, but then like the end fruit of it, literally with the trees, is that they're setting up men for success, like Aragorn's people for success, right? So I guess it has something to do with that, and it goes along with Tolkien's like favorite quote, history's one long defeat, you know, where... Mm-hmm. In time, everything kind of like in this life, everything fades away, but then like there will be some final victory beyond the end of time where Manwë will just be like, hey, no, Melkor, Sauron, we're not dealing with this. Stop it, you're done once and for all, right? But until then, I don't know, this is kind of what you're stuck with or the way it goes, but yeah,
right.
And I don't know, it just matches up better with I don't know, history, I guess. History and lore, or mythology as a whole, I would say. But yeah, so... Anyways, Sauron's a Maiar. That means they're going to send Maiar out And as we said, Maiar are also what in the Venn diagrams?
Ainur?
Right, Ainur. So these guys were all part of the music of the Ainur.
Okay.
Isn't that crazy? Okay. Right, so and if we remember the music of the Ainur, what happened there was every Iluvatar creates them all. And then he starts saying, all right, make the theme, make the music, right? And they make a first theme, and then Melkor kind of ruins it a little bit, but Iluvatar gets all his people, the good people to start playing, like, all right, play the second theme amidst this, and then Melkor ruins that one, and then they do a third theme too, and it takes up the best notes of Melkor's thing, but Melkor's influencing all the people around him, right? And so, anyways, after that, Iluvatar says, behold your minstrelry, right? And then he reveals, like, oh, this is what your music made. And it gives them a vision of the world. And they watch it on, like, 4x speed. But then Iluvatar takes it away. And then he creates the world. All of them enter into the world because they saw the vision. It was awesome. But then they realize, oh, the vision's not achieved. Now we have to make the world, right? And so then they make Middle-earth and build Valinor in the west of it, right? But anyways, the Maiar, Sauron, the Maiar that they're going to send as wizards, they were all part of that. Isn't that crazy? But this also, like, you start to get an idea, like, all right, maybe this is where Gandalf's foresight comes from. You know, at least that's my thought. You know, he always mentions how he's got the foresight. Then that conversation with Thorin, he was saying, yeah, I'm foresighted at least a little bit, right? But this also says, I think this is just a practical point, what Tolkien's kind of trying to flesh out, like, when they go to Middle Earth and they're clad in flesh, they're going to kind of lose some of this foresight. They're going to have more mortal qualities about them, basically, when they become the wizards, you know? So I don't know. It's kind of interesting that this is what they're running with, because it's just like, yeah, like you're kind of, what you were kind of hinting at, like, why doesn't Manwë just go himself? It's like, this sounds like a very dangerous game that they're just going to play and send and do this. But it's like, I don't know. Like, it's always the descending generations. So that's just always how it is, like, basically across most mythologies, right? So I guess we got to go with it. You know? Okay. So who of the Maiar are they going to pick, right? So here, all right. So the first choice, Ale. Do you remember Ale? Take a quiz guess. Who was Ale? He's a Valar.
Ale is one of the Valar kind of associated with water. No, that's.
You know who water is.
Yeah, never mind.
Water's Olmo.
Olmo, right. And Orome is kind of the hunter. Right?
Oh, good, good, good. Okay, Orome is the hunter. Yeah. What's Ale?
Ale, axe, fighting, sword.
Clifford.
What?
I don't know how to reenact it.
Hammer, anvil.
Yes. Okay. What?
Blacksmith.
Right.
Okay. Like the Vulcan. Okay.
The craftsman kind of god, right? Okay.
Okay.
All right. So he recommends Kurumo, and Kurumo, whenever you see Kuru, that's the prefix for crafty. Okay. So that's Saruman. Okay. All right, that's Saruman. So this makes perfect sense. Ale is the blacksmith, craftsman kind of god. He taught Fëanor a lot. Of course, Saruman, you know, would be someone that would be under him, right? You know, based on everything we've read in Lord of the Rings, like Saruman, he was all about ring lore. He was all about getting knowledge and perfecting his craft at whatever, and to the point where he thought he could handle the rings. So, all right, so that's one thing. Okay. What's also interesting is, of all the Valar, Ale was the closest, and we talked about this on the show at some point, Ale was the closest to Melkor in, like, kind of similar qualities. And Ale, one of the things that he did was he made the dwarves, you know, because he couldn't wait for men and elves to wake up. And so then Iluvatar's like, no, what are you doing? And so Ale was going to kind of, like, kill him, like how Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac, but he didn't. Because Iluvatar said, you don't have to do that. But so anyways, Ale was... The moral of that story was Ale was more obedient than Melkor ever was. But what's also interesting is when all the Maiar enter the world and before there's much evil besides just Melkor, one of the Maiar spirits that was under Ale was also Sauron himself, which is kind of crazy. But he's one of the Sauron's one of the first converts to Melkor's evilness, I guess. But he was originally... a good guy, craftsman kind of guy under Ale as well. Okay. So this all is interesting that, you know, Ale's going to choose Saruman. Makes total sense, right? All right. So another Valar, Yavanna, she's the maker of the two trees. So she's the nature goddess, Mother Earth kind of figure. She asks Saruman, actually, I guess, to take Radagast with him.
Okay.
So that also is makes sense because Radagast, he was lives in Mirkwood, nature hippie, you know, and I don't know, she made the two trees, loves all the forest. She was the one that requested the creation of the Ents and maybe even Manwë sending out the eagles to him and stuff. So of course Radagast would be kind of her choice to go, right?
Right.
Orome recommends one of the blue wizards. Orome is the hunter god, and the blue wizard requests a friend to go with them, and they're going to end up being, who's going to end up being the other blue wizard. And these blue wizards, we don't exactly know what they're going to do or where they're going to go, but apparently it was east. And Orome was the Valar who hung out most in the far east, like east of the Middle Earth, any Middle Earth maps you ever see. So that makes sense that he's, I don't know, they would pick the blue wizards who have to go that far east, I guess. You know, they're not super important anyways. But here's the coolest part. At this hypothetical council, Manwë asks, where's Olorin? Okay. And at the beginning of the Silmarillion, only the most attentive readers to Lord of the Rings will have put together that Olorin, because at one point Faramir or somebody calls Gandalf Olorin somewhere in Lord of the Rings itself. Okay. But he's mentioned in the Silmarillion among the Maiar at the beginning. And you want to read what it says in the Silmarillion about him?
Wisest of the Maiar was Olorin. His ways took him often to the house of Nienna, and of her he learned pity and patience. Of Melian much is told in the Quenta Silmarillion, but of Olorin that tale does not speak, for though he loved the elves, he walked among them unseen, or in form as one of them, and they did not know whence came the fair visions or the promptings of wisdom that he put into their hearts. In later days he was the friend of all the children of Iluvatar, and took pity on their sorrows, and those who listened to him awoke from despair and put away the imaginations of darkness.
Okay, so what'd you think of that?
So he sounds like he's in disguise from the beginning, even before he's commanded to be so, to do so, to go into Middle Earth. Like, it kind of sounds like he's walking in disguise in Valinor amongst the elves.
Yeah, and so that might be practical, because, like, then the Noldor, who are still in Middle-earth in the Second and Third Age, who had lived in Valinor like Galadriel, right? He didn't exactly know her personally before. That might be a practical detail for that. But I thought the most interesting thing was, like, he learned pity and patience from Nienna, who's one of the Valar. And she's like kind of Queen of Sorrows kind of figure. But anyways.
Yeah. Also, bold statement, that opening line, wisest of the Maiar was Olorin.
Well,
that's significant, right?
I mean, that's saying a lot for sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. But it's, I don't know. Gandalf's, we've talked about it before. It's like Saruman's kind of the most knowledgeable, would have theoretically been the most practical, but yeah, wisest, just, you know, especially morally wise, yeah, it's gotta be Gandalf, as we've seen throughout Lord of the Rings, right? But the pity and patience part too, I think, like, oh, that goes straight to the, it was pity that stayed Bilbo's hand, you know, and Bilbo's pity is going to rule the fate of everybody, and it does, right? Because nobody ever, everybody pities Gollum, gives him mercy, doesn't kill him, and then, like, that's how they see through the destruction of the ring, right? Okay, so anyways, they're in the middle of this council, and Manwë's asking for this Lauren guy, right? And so then Jared Tolkien or Christopher Tolkien, one of the two, they just write out, okay. And Lauren, who is clad in gray and having just entered from a journey, had seated himself at the edge of the council, asked what Manwë would have of him. Manwë replied that he wished Olorin to go as the fifth messenger to Middle-earth. And it is remarked in parentheses that Olorin was a lover of the Eldar that remained in Valinor. Okay, and apparently that helps explain Manwë's choice a little bit more of why him. But Olorin declared that he was too weak for such a task and that he feared Sauron. Then Manwë said that that was all the more reason why he should go. Okay? which I love. Right. So Manwi is basically seeing, all right, I see hidden greatness in this Aloran Gandalf guy. I mean, he's already the wisest of the Maiar, right? But then again, this is also from the Silmarillion. There could easily be like a throwaway line, you know, like where you just give out superlatives, right?
Right. Everyone has to be a superlative.
Right.
Yeah, open a paragraph with the superlative.
Right, but I think the biggest thing there is like Manwi just instantly knows this humility is going to serve this Gandalf Aloran guy very well. So like all the more reason he should go. If he doesn't think he's a match for Sauron, I think
all the better.
That's going to be a good quality that's going to help him through with this, right?
Mm.
So back to the comments about how the Istari do in Middle Earth. Tolkien says, "Now the White Messenger in later days became known among the elves as Curunir, the man of craft, and the tongues of northern men, Saruman. But that was after he returned from his many journeys and came into the realm of Gondor and there abode at Isengard, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Of the blue wizards, little is known in the West, and they have no names save Ithrien Luin, the blue wizards. For they passed into the East with Curunir, that's Saruman, but they never returned. Mm-hmm. And whether they remained in the East, pursuing the purposes for which they were sent, or perished, or as somehow were ensnared by Sauron and became his servants, it is not known." Okay? But then he also adds, he adds somewhere in a 1958 letter, Tolkien adds, "I think the blue wizards sent as emissaries to distant regions, east and south, far out of Numenorean range, missionaries into occupied lands, that is to basically like the men enslaved by Sauron to the to the south and east of the Middle-earth map, you know? They're basically sent to those people, right? What success they had, I do not know, but I fear that they failed, as Saruman did, though doubtless in different ways. And I suspect they were founders or beginners of secret cults and magic traditions that outlasted the fall of Sauron." All right?
Mm.
Interesting. I don't know. What do you think of those back notes of the characters we never met?
I mean, helpful explanation for where they went and why they're not helping out.
Right.
It's
kind of interesting that they would the people really, really entrenched, enslaved by Sauron would actually get helpers to him. That's kind of a cool idea.
Yeah. It's also like this whole bit that we're going through is reinforcing so strongly like the humanness of these god characters.
Yeah.
Like the fact that they can fall off their path, not achieve their goals, they're not omniscient.
Mm-hmm.
They're subject to all these things we don't think of gods being subject to. They're functioning like basically like humans in the story, minus the mortality and the regular lifespan part.
Yeah.
Plus extra wisdom, of course. So it's pretty interesting when you put that in the context of the big story. Like why even deal with this? Why not just have this epic showdown of forces of the Valar? But it feels like, to what you were saying earlier about like a lot of mythology shifting from like the gods duking it out all the way down to like more and more practical, less gods, more human reality.
Yeah.
All the way down to like the most relatable stuff. This is like in that continuum, getting closer to the modern day, where there's like these influential characters who are not omnipotent.
Right. All right. So to add to that, the Istari, it says in the book here, the Istari, being clad in bodies of Middle Earth, might even as men and elves fall away from their purposes and do evil, forgetting the good in search for power to affect it. Okay, that sounds exactly like Saruman.
Yes.
All right. For it is said indeed that being embodied, the Istari had need to learn much anew by slow experience. And though they knew whence they came, the memory of the Blessed Realm was to them a vision from afar off, for which, so long as they remained true to their mission, they yearned exceedingly. Thus, by enduring of free will the pangs of exile and the deceits of Sauron, they might redress the evils of that time. So, yeah, I mean, it's also kind of weird. Like, they're accepting this mission freely, but then as soon as they get somewhat close to mortal bodies, they're like, oh man, I wish I was back in Valinor. Or, I yearn to complete my mission so that I can get back to Valinor, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But also, like, makes them feel even more mortal. I guess in every sense almost. But yeah. Again, talk about dangerous games. Just like, this is your plan for this generation, I guess. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But, and that also kind of might explain, like, in the music of the Ainur, they saw, like, the vision of the world on, I keep saying, quadruple speed. But then this seems to say, like, well, now they can't even remember Valinor very well, besides that they yearn for it when they're doing good on their mission. But then,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Gandalf always talks about this foresight, and I think he always has it from the nuggets of that original vision of the world that he saw before the world was even created, but from the music of the Ainur. I don't know. I always mm-hmm. like to think that, but maybe that's not the case. Then again, I don't know if Tolkien ever finished fleshing out these ideas. Any thoughts?
Nah.
Okay. All right. We're finishing up here, too. Because this got longer again than I expected. I'll have to keep going. Okay. Indeed, of all the Istari, only one remained faithful, and he was the last comer. For Radagast the Fourth became enamored of the many beasts and birds that dwelt in Middle-earth, and forsook elves and men, and spent his days among the wild creatures. Thus he got his name, which is in the tongue of the Numenor of old, and signifies, it is said, tender of beasts. And Curunir Lan, Saruman the White, fell from his high errand, and becoming proud and impatient and enamored of power, sought to have his own will by force, and to oust Sauron. This is kind of what you're actually talking about. But he was ensnared by the dark spirit, mightier than he. But the last comer was named among the elves Mithrandir, the Grey Pilgrim, for he dwelt in no place and gathered to himself neither wealth nor followers, but ever went to and fro the Westlands from Gondor to Angmar, and from Lindon to Lorien, befriending all folk in times of need. Warm and eager was his spirit, for he was the enemy of Sauron, opposing the fire that devours the waste with fire that kindles and suckers and wane hope and distress, but his joy and his swift wrath were veiled in fragments gray as ash, so that those who knew him well glimpsed the flame that was in him. Merry he could be, and kindly to the young and simple, and yet quick at times to sharp speech and the rebuking of folly, but he was not proud, and sought neither power nor praise, and thus far and wide he was beloved among all those that were not themselves proud. Mostly he journeyed unwearingly on foot, leaning on a staff, and he was called among men of the north Gandalf, the elf of the wand. For remember, because they thought they were elves. Mm-hmm. For they deemed him, though in error, as has been said, to be of elf kind, since he would at times work wonders among them, loving especially the beauty of fire, and yet such marvels he wrought mostly for mirth and delight, and desired not that any should hold him in awe or take his counsels out of fear. Elsewhere it is told how it was when Sauron arose again, he also arose and partly revealed his power, and becoming the chief mover of the resistance to Sauron, was at last victorious and brought all by the vigilance and labor to the end, which the valor under the one that is above them had designed. Yet it is said in the ending of the task for which he came, he suffered greatly and was slain, and being sent back from death for a brief while, was clothed then in white and became a radiant flame, yet veiled, still saved in great need. And when all was over and the shadow of Sauron was removed, he departed forever over the sea. And that basically, hopefully, would fully explain everything. So, the biggest takeaway, though, is Gandalf was Manwë's pick. Manwë basically picked him almost mostly because of his humility. And Gandalf was the only one of the wizards that actually saw everything through. That's the craziest part.
Yeah. Which is arguably the foresight that Manwë had, is not that Gandalf was the strongest, but he was strong enough to do the job, even if he was mediocrely strong. Yeah. It was the fact that he was humble that eventually led to him not going astray, whereas four of the other five went astray, even if they were arguably more talented or stronger or something like
that. Right. Saruman was the strongest and the mightiest and the most knowledgeable and the most practical mm-hmm. choice, but Gandalf, the humble, simple, loyal one, is the one that sees it through.
pretty awesome.
Which we could argue is like there's some parallels with the hobbits, right?
Right. Besides that, like Gandalf has superlatives after superlatives about him, but yes.
Yes. The hobbits don't. Yes.
But yeah, it's definitely in that similar vein.
Similar
yeah.
concept.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. All right, so hopefully that was also another longer episode than I expected, but other than that, I don't know if I have anything else for this, Clifford.
No, nothing here.
Yeah, I'm glad we got to do this one, though, because that was that's a fun topic, and yeah, everybody should know that, because if you're super into Lord of the Rings, so yeah. All right, if that's it, though, we can end it here. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Okay, thanks, y'all.